The Dr. Peter Bragan Hour, Mondays at 5 p.m. on the Progressive Radio Network.
Are you ready for the conscience of psychiatry? For the best-selling author of Talking Back to Prozac, Toxic Psychiatry, and Medication Madness? It's the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with guests and callers seeking the truth about psychiatry and psychotherapy and how you can make the most of your own life right here on the Progressive Radio Network.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And welcome again to the Conscience of Psychiatry. Today, I'm not going to have a guest. I've decided to devote the show to a subject that people have been asking me to talk about at more length. And that subject is the antipsychotic drugs and the treatment of really disturbed people. Because of the interest in this, in fact, I focused a great deal of my time at our annual conference this past April, which, by the way, we will hold again this coming April. I put a lot of time into this because it's kind of the litmus test of my views. It's kind of the litmus test of empathic therapy. And that test is, do we need at least the antipsychotic drugs for people diagnosed schizophrenic? And if we don't use the antipsychotic drugs, what will we use? So that's what I'm going to talk about today. And I'm going to start out with the problem of antipsychotic drugs in general. As some of you already know, I got started in psychiatry as an 18-year-old in college as a volunteer and then the director of the Harvard Radcliffe Mental Hospital College Volunteer Program. And the new drugs, really Thorazine or chlorpromazine, didn't come in until I'd been working for a little while already in the volunteer program. So I got to see these drugs from the beginning. Well, before the drugs came in, when you walked down the hospital wards, as dismal and miserable as they were, and as battered as the patients were by various kinds of old-fashioned toxic agents and by lobotomy and by shock treatment, there was still a liveliness. People still protested. People still complained. People still begged for attention. You could see the human being beneath all the damage. But with the advent of Thorazine, you couldn't see the person anymore because it began to look like so-called mental illness was a sleeping disease, or if not a sleeping disease, a walking zombie disease, because that's what people looked like on the neuroleptics. And that's true to this day if you reach a sufficiently effective dose of any neuroleptic, pretty much. You're going to get a zombie effect. Well, what was going on with these drugs? The claim was they were specific for schizophrenia, but that claim didn't come till much later. Because in the beginning, the pioneers knew exactly what they were doing. Physicians like Lehman, who introduced the drug to North America, knew they were causing a chemical lobotomy. They knew this. They didn't know the mechanism, but they knew their patients looked lobotomized. That while they weren't necessarily falling asleep, they lacked initiative. They lacked caring. They lacked spontaneity. They lacked engagement. They were reduced in their ability to connect, to be autonomous, to be individuals. They became more robotic. It was very clear what was going on. And as for being specific for schizophrenia, they gave it to everyone in the hospital. Old people with strokes, children, adults with syphilis, adults with psychosis, criminals on the criminal ward, violent people. They knew that they had found a non-specific lobotomizing agent. And I talk about this. By the way, everything I'm going to talk to you about today is in my major medical textbook, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, in 2008. So I'm not going to be citing a lot of stuff, but if you want the scientific references, you can get thousands of them in the Brain Disabling Treatment. And if you want some of the broader background, you can go to Toxic Psychiatry. Between those two, it'll more than cover and give you the references for everything today. So they knew they were producing this non-specific lobotomy effect. Nor could there be much doubt about it, despite modern claims for its being sort of an anti-schizophrenic drug or an antipsychotic drug, because they were being used in prisons, they were being used in old age homes, they were being used in psycho prisons. By the time Haldol came around, which was another big advance because it was just a lot more potent even than the earlier drugs in many ways, and hence more damaging, by the time Haldol came around, it was being used in Russian psycho prisons and Cuban psycho prisons. And I remember vividly the interview the New York Times did with a Soviet dissident who escaped, and he explained how when he was put on Haldol in doses lower than we routinely used in our hospitals, how he first lost his abstract interest in science, because that was like the newly acquired part of him. And then he lost his interest in his family life. And finally, he just lost interest in everything as he became more and more lobotomized by the Haldol. Years ago, I debated a famous biological psychiatrist, one of the few who dared, and he never dared debate me again on a radio show back in the 80s. And in the middle of his arguing that these things were specific for schizophrenia, I pointed out all the material I just told you about. And he said, well, all these people have latent schizophrenia. So then I hit him with the final observation. Well, it's also used in veterinary medicine. When you shoot the lion with a dart and he becomes malleable, you can move his limbs around, you can take a thorn out of his paw, and while he's awake, he won't attack you. You've shot him with a so-called antipsychotic drug, or as they were originally and more accurately called, neuroleptics. Neuroleptic meant bound to or toxic to the neuron, the brain cell. Well, there was no answer for that, of course, except to get really, really mad and never debate me again. Now, what's the mechanism? It's not a mystery. It's not a mystery. When I first started looking into how do these drugs work, when I first started to really want to know what's the chemical mechanism, it wasn't really hard to find. I remember looking in a textbook and seeing a picture of the brain and of the nerve tracts that came from deep in the brain, from a place called the basal ganglia and its associated substantia nigra. There were these nerve fibers going up to the frontal lobe, and they were called and still are called dopamine nerves or dopaminergic nerves, nerves where the impulse is transmitted by one cell sending dopamine across the synapse to another cell and firing it. Well, this was the major bundle of nerves to the frontal lobes of the brain, and the diagram demonstrated how these new drugs cut that bundle chemically. Well, that wasn't hard to understand. So I went and I looked at the caption, and I expected to read, "These drugs cause the chemical lobotomy. This is an illustration." Instead, it said, since these drugs disrupt dopamine and it helps patients, schizophrenics must have a dopamine excess that's being reduced. Well, that was ridiculous. That was a far-fetched, unproven speculation, still without meaning or any evidence. The truth was simple. You were cutting back on dopamine neurotransmission to the frontal lobes, causing a lobotomy. And it would be done to a rat. It would be done to a cat or dog. It would be done to a criminal, to an ordinary person, or to anybody. Some of these drugs suppress vomiting, so they're used to treat nausea and vomiting in small doses. And I used to have a dog who was very independent. His name was Ted. He was a very independent dog, my Teddy. And He didn't like to do what he was told. He liked to think about it. He wasn't, he wasn't obstructionist or difficult, or he just liked to think about it. You'd say, come, Ted, and he'd think about it, and then he'd come. And he had a problem of throwing up in the car. So finally, without thinking about what it was in particular, we gave him a pill from the vet. And my daughter Allie, who was a little girl at the time, took him out to the car, and she came back and she said, I don't know what's happened to Ted. I asked him to get in the car and he just got in. He just listened to me. Well, Ted had been given a so-called antipsychotic or neuroleptic for his nausea in the automobile. These drugs do the same thing to everybody. And in addition with, individual variation and so on, but basically to all mammals, they'll do the same thing. In addition, they also suppress the activity of the reticular activating system. The reticular activating system is the core source of energy in the lower brain. And when you suppress it, you suppress the overall energy of the individual. So there's no question about how they work. And all of the effective neuroleptics have their effect by suppressing dopamine 2. It's a very specific subtype of dopamine. The so-called newer or atypical neuroleptics, the old ones are like Thorazine and Stelazine and Melaril and Haldol. The newer ones like Abilify and Geodone and Invega, Risperdal, Seroquel, Zyprexa, they all suppress dopamine. So even though they're supposedly new or second or third generation or atypical, they actually have that same old dreadful effect of suppressing dopamine. And the degree of their effectiveness depends on how much they suppress dopamine or how much you give to the patient until you've suppressed dopamine. Risperdal and Zyprexa, for example, really are indistinguishable in their potency to suppress dopamine, and they just have all the same effects. They cause zombie children and zombie adults as well as any other drug will. But if given in sufficient doses, they all do that. Now, I'm not going to take a break, but I'm going to just clear my throat for a minute. Okay. I've got this little gadget here which is supposed to mute, but it's a deadly mechanism, and I have to worry about using it. Now, when you suppress dopamine, you not only disrupt neurotransmission to the frontal lobes, you actually suppress a motor center, which is also in the origin of these drugs, in the basal ganglia. Specifically in an area called the basal ganglia and an area called the tegmentum. And when you suppress this area, what do you get? You get Parkinsonism. You get Parkinsonism. And I'm going to take a break now. When we come back, I'm going to explain to you how Parkinsonism relates to the lobotomy.
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Radio Network, your number one source for all things progressive.
Hey, did you miss your favorite show? Don't worry, PRN has you covered. Just log on to ProgressiveRadioNetwork.com and go to the archive page where you can choose from any of our great programs. Listen or download shows from yesterday or even ones dating months back. The Progressive Radio Network, striving to make your lives easier.
This is Bill Bowie.
And this is Kelsey Flynn.
Of Sea Change Radio, covering the shift to sustainability.
We bring you news and interviews
with the likes of Wangari Maathai, Bill McKibben, Hazel Henderson, Paul Hawken, Francis Moore LePay, and many others. Tune in to Sea Change Radio here on the Progressive Radio Network on Saturdays at 7 in the evening.
You're listening to Bhavani, and I'd like to welcome you every Wednesday on the Progressive Radio Network to join me for my show called I Eat Green, where every Wednesday we will talk about eating healthy and eating sustainably for our planet. So join me every Wednesday from 5 to 6.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
And this is Dr. Peter Breggin coming back to you. We're talking today about the antipsychotic drugs, the neuroleptic drugs. Abilify, Geodone, Clozaril, Invega, Risperdal, Seroquel, Zyprexa are the new ones. The old ones are many drugs, including Haldol, Thorazine, Stelazine, Novane, and so on. And what I talked about in the beginning was the suppression, the cutting off of dopamine neurotransmission to the frontal lobes and how that causes lobotomy. Now, the second thing that it does at the same time is to suppress the coordination and initiation of activity centers. The basal ganglia are not only the origin of the nerves that go to the frontal lobes, they're also the origin of the nerves that allow us to initiate our activity. They're kind of the interface between free will and your musculature. When you damage that area, you lose control of your musculature. Huntington's chorea attacks that area. Parkinsonism attacks that area. Now, when you suppress these dopamine cells, and if you really harm them, you cause a Parkinsonian syndrome that's different from the ordinary Parkinsonism that comes from old age or from trauma or from disease. And you literally create a chemical straitjacket, because in Parkinsonism, everything slows down. The walk becomes slow and small. You stoop. Your movements are slowed down. Your facial expression is so slowed down, people can't even tell what you're feeling. You can't express what you're feeling. You may also get a tremor. You may drool because of difficulty swallowing. You get a zombie effect in appearance. And anyone who's worked with patients on the antipsychotic or neuroleptic drugs knows the zombie effect. It's a characteristic that can be achieved as long as you go high enough. In fact, in the old days when docs were more blatant about what they were doing, they used to say, my colleagues used to say, to get the drug effect, you got to cause some Parkinsonism. You got to slow the person down. You also slow down the emotions in Parkinsonism, but these drugs go further. Their impact is so great on dopamine that they also cut off transmission of the frontal lobe. So you get Parkinsonism along with your lobotomy. Now, the brain does not respond well to any of this. The brain resents this metaphorically. It fights back. And one of the things it does is to proliferate, to increase the number of cells that receive dopamine, the receptors for dopamine. So I want you to just picture this. It's very simple. The drug is cutting off the ability of the cell to use dopamine. So it's blocking dopamine activity. So the cell tries to compensate by getting more and more receptors for dopamine. So, okay, I've got less dopamine. I'll get more receptors. I'll work harder. And they get super sensitive. The receptors increase in number. They get super sensitive. They get stronger. Now, that's an abnormality. And when that abnormality grows, what do you think you get? Well, you get the opposite of the Parkinsonism, the original slowing. You now get a hyperactivity. That hyperactivity is tardive dyskinesia. The Parkinsonism rarely becomes permanent. The tardive dyskinesia commonly becomes permanent. So that even after you stop the drug, you have these hyperactive, extremely intense dopamine receptors, as well as other disorders going on around them, that are producing abnormal movements. And these movements can vary from mild to wholly disabling. Disabling. The person can't stand up. The person muscles throw themselves against the wall, whip the neck around, make the feet constantly go into a running motion. Usually, but not always, the tongue is involved. Quite often it's one of the early signs. A person's tongue starts to protrude or go into the cheek, get in the way of swallowing, get in the way of talking and drinking. The eyes can start blinking. The face can be grimacing. And you can get a particular kind of tardive dyskinesia that is a dystonia. It causes spasms, dystonic spasms. The neck gets all awry and out of shape and horribly painful. A lot of the legal cases I've been involved with have been patients who are in permanent agony from their necks and shoulders and even their torsos being twisted out of shape. It can affect fingers and toes. The person can look like they're trying to play the guitar in some bizarre fashion. An arm can raise, a foot can curl. You can get the flexing or extending of toes. All the voluntary muscles can be involved. That's breathing can be involved. Speech can be involved. The larynx, the diaphragm. And I've seen cases of people permanently disabled or in permanent pain. And one of the more agonizing forms is called tardive akathisia. Akathisia, A-K-A-T-H-I-S-A. Tardive akathisia. In that form of the disorder, the individual feels an inner agitation that's like being tortured from the inside out, usually accompanied by a terrible restlessness and desire to move about. But it can occur even without that, just with this terrible inner agitation that drives you to do something and you don't even know what it is. And even if you look in a conventional document like the Diagnostic and Statistical Manual of Mental Disorders and look up akathisia, and they will tell you about acute akathisia and how it drives people to feel violent, suicidal, and to make people more psychotic. And you often see patients who have been driven into this state by the drugs, maybe even into the permanent long-term part of it, which is the tardive akathisia. That's the long term. And the doctors don't see it, and then they end up giving the patients drugs or shock treatment, more drugs or shock treatment. But these are a series of just terrible disorders. The tardive disorders, tardive dystonia, tardive akathisia, general tardive dyskinesia, that can be a movement disorder of any muscle of your body. Now, what are the rates of this disorder? They're astronomical. They're astronomical. Even by the admissions of the tardive dyskinesia task forces, two of them that have been put out by the American Psychiatric Association, the rate is between 5 and 8% a year cumulative in otherwise healthy people. Let's just take the 5% rate. That means 15% of people in 3 years are going to get tardive dyskinesia. Now, these rates, and now, as you get older, it gets worse. The elderly, and there are at least 6-7 controlled clinical trials that show this. I cite them in my book, Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry. All this data is in the book. If you're getting to be 55 or 60, or God forbid you're as old as I am in your 70s, your rate of tardive dyskinesia is 20% or more a year. Astronomical. These drugs shouldn't be on the market. Astronomical. Now, what about the newer ones? What do we know about them? Are they really better? No, they are not. They just claim to be better, but the FDA requires the same warning for all the drugs, and that tells you something. Even the FDA, in its desire to please the drug companies, can't find that any one of the drugs is less likely to cause TD than any other of the drugs, and we don't have a lot of good studies on that, But I've seen tardive dyskinesia caused by Seroquel. I've seen it caused by Abilify. I've seen a lot of it, dozens of cases, caused by Risperdal and caused by Zyprexa. So you do get tardive dyskinesia. In fact, you get all the old problems with tardive dyskinesia, all the old problems, including tardive dyskinesia, with the new drugs. But then you get some things that are even worse. You get even more, probably even more, prolactin production, which produces gynecomastia, artificially inflated breasts. We have 10-year-old boys with breasts that are inflated by these drugs, by taking Risperdal, Zyprexa, Risperdal, a particular offender. And in some cases, these children, growth can't be stopped even by surgery. These children are humiliated. These children are disfigured. You get strokes and death in the elderly. Big black box warning about this with all of the newer ones. And you get something called a metabolic syndrome, a syndrome that leads to heart attack and stroke. And it includes obesity from these drugs, elevated blood sugar, and then even diabetes. I've been an expert, medical expert, in cases of fatal diabetes and pancreatitis from these drugs. You get heart disease. You get a particular problem of a prolonged QT interval, but you get also weakened heart muscle. Your cholesterol goes up. These drugs are a prescription for a heart attack. Now, you also get something else that's a pretty terrible disorder with all these drugs. It's called neuroleptic malignant syndrome. Neuroleptic malignant syndrome. It's as bad as it sounds. It's like an encephalitis. Out of the blue, patients get fever and chills, and they get their minds begin to come apart. They may get high blood pressure along with the fever or elevated heart rate. They often get rigid, or they get a tardive dyskinesia-like syndrome. And doctors often fail to recognize that. Doctors have been taught it's rare. What does rare mean? Well, actually, studies that have looked at it have found rates above 1%, 1 out of 100, get this disease, which is fatal if untreated in 20% of cases. A severe disease. DeLay and Deniker, who first developed first developed Thorazine, they knew right away they were doing this. They knew right away they were developing these tardive phenomena, these abnormal movements. But they knew they were creating something that looked just like encephalitis. They even wrote, we could create an epidemic, a worldwide encephalitis-like disorder with these drugs. And indeed, we've done that by means of the neuroleptics causing neuroleptic malignant syndrome. It's only the beginning. These drugs shorten lifespan. We've got a variety of studies now. One shows a 20-year loss of life when you take these drugs for your lifetime. And why do these drugs cause death? Well, I've given you a lot of reasons already. I mean, a dozen maybe of descriptions of things that can kill you. But in addition, because they cause indifference, people don't take care of themselves. Because they cause indifference, people don't take care of themselves. Lobotomized people don't take care of themselves. Now, how permanent is the lobotomy? Well, we know more and more now. I've been writing about this for years. We've known it from animal studies that, in fact, these drugs kill brain cells, and we now have studies showing atrophy of the brain in human beings. If these drugs were being given to anyone other than mental patients, and if they weren't being protected by the FDA, they'd be outlawed. They have such horrendously bad effects on human beings. And I'm not even pretending in this half hour with a break in the middle that I just had, I'm not even pretending to cover all the things these drugs do. I've been focusing on some of their major effects. I haven't even gotten all of their major ill effects. The list is endless, literally endless, because these drugs are toxic to human beings. They are toxic to cells. We have studies that I cite in brain disabling treatment going back generations showing it toxic to mitochondria. These are terrible drugs. We could do without them. And after the half-hour break, I'll return a little bit to the toxicity of these drugs, and then I want to talk with you more about the alternative to these drugs, because they're not the best way of treating a person diagnosed with schizophrenia. They're not the best way at all. There's much better ways of helping people who are suffering from really severe disturbances, even with hallucinations and other severe problems. There's just tons of better ways of helping them. Basically, we'll find that the best way to help is through human relationship, through good therapy, either in a hospital or in the home. Human beings are the best way to help other disturbed human beings. And people will be able to call in. I'm glad I haven't had any calls today, but you can call in and ask questions if you want about these drugs. Can we go to break now?
You are listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour on the Progressive Radio Network. Stay tuned, stay in touch, and call in with your questions at 888-874-4888. That's 888-874-4888.
Progressive Radio Network each day for the best progressive minds in the world.
Hello, I'm Carol Brier, host of Community Currency, connecting people, ideas, important information, nurturing human renaissance, seeking to transform disintegrating empire into healthy, problem-solving, creative, evolutionary, peaceful communities. To hear us, listen every Thursdays, 5 to 6 p.m. on Progressive Radio Network.
Hi, I'm Eric Davis, host of Expanding Mind. Join me and co-host Maja Daou each week as we explore the culture of consciousness, spirituality, neuroscience, media tech, and all manner of wonders and esoterica. Expanding Mind streams every Thursday at 2 p.m. Eastern Standard Time on the Progressive Radio Network. Keep your mind open.
Houston, we have a problem.
Hi, I'm Christiane Brown. In today's 24-hour news cycle, most people get about a minute of real truth. Not on the Solution Zone. Every week, I bring in America's best-known activists, bloggers, authors, and politicians to uncover the hidden issues that help separate the truth from the spin.
The Solution Zone with Christiane Brown, every Wednesday at 3 on Progressive Radio Network.
Listening to the Progressive Radio Network, your number one source for progressive commentary.
And this is Dr. Peter Bragan. And I hope that this first half hour hasn't been too much for you. It's a lot to hear all of this. And I want to emphasize that I've documented all of this in enormous detail in Brain Disabling Treatments in Psychiatry, the second edition in 2008. And a lot of this you can simply Google. Now, I want to, in a few minutes, to get on and to talk some about what's going on in ways to help people without drugs. I also want to apologize for my voice, like so many people around the world. I'm recovering from a fairly bad head cold that for at least 2 weeks now has been affecting my voice, and I apologize for that. Now, I understand we have Katie from Missouri who has a question. Katie, are you there?
Yes. It's Kathy, actually.
Kathy. It says Kathy. I'm speaking Katie.
No problem.
Go ahead.
I suffered a severe traumatic brain injury in 1995 from a car accident. And in my recovery, I was placed on an antidepressant, which I was on for years. And then when I came back home after being at college, I was placed on a mood stabilizer because of the effects the antidepressant had on me. And I went off the antidepressant with my doctor. I stopped taking it today. And my question is...
Today?
Yes, today, actually. I stopped taking Cymbalta today.
And did you taper slowly? Or?
Yes, I tapered slowly with my doctor's, with her advice.
Good.
You know, and but because I want to go off the Lamictal, I asked the first time that I called, but then I called back and said I was going to do this. You know, I was sick and tired of being on this medicine for 15 years and it not doing anything, but it affects my endurance. I'm an athlete, see?
Mm-hmm.
And I know.
Well, tell me now where exactly you are with the drugs. You've come off of the Celexa.
The Cymbalta.
Cymbalta.
Yes. I was on Paxil at first.
What are you on now?
Nothing.
Okay.
No antidepressant. I came off of it.
Do you have a question? I think this is wonderful. I think
yes.
It's outstanding that you have a psychiatrist who's willing to withdraw you from medication.
Yes.
Keep in mind, Kathy, that the next few weeks could be very up and down for you.
Okay.
Because
well,
the few
that's
weeks
my
after
question,
you stop
I guess.
The drugs, yeah, it could be very up and down. Any funny, abnormal, weird feeling you get could be from the medication. You
well,
could get
I'm,
high. You
I'm,
could get
I'm
low.
I'm also on Cytomel for depression.
And why are you on that?
Because I also found online that there's a hormonal deficiency after a severe TBI, and
well,
my body
I mean, were you
doesn't
actually
make check
to see if your
anymore.
Thyroid was working?
Pardon me?
Were you actually checked to see if your thyroid was working? Or
yes, I was.
Was it working?
It was. I think so, but
well,
I am on the maximum.
Kathy, let me just say a couple of things. First, it is wonderful that you're working with a doctor who will take you off medications, because when you've had a TBI, a traumatic brain injury,
yeah,
medication can have an even worse effect on you than if your brain is functioning totally normally on all its cylinders.
Yeah.
So when you have an injury, the drugs have more of a tendency to cause all the possible bad effects. The second thing is it's really good that you didn't get put on the antipsychotic drugs. And the third thing is, before I finish, is just to remind you that you may go through some ups and downs now and work with your doctor on it. If you've come off too fast, you may have to go back and take a little bit again for a while. But just keep in mind that you might have your ups and downs as you come off the drug.
Actually,
do you have any last question, Kathy?
I am on Lamictal, and I want to go off that too. And
well,
I
give
want
yourself
to know
a chance
can...
to be off of the antidepressant.
For longer?
Cymbalta, before you come off the Lamictal. Just give yourself a little chance, all right?
For how long?
Oh, work with your doc on that. That's
well,
too, that's
she,
too
because
much.
Because I'm, like, she doesn't want to treat me anymore.
You need to find it. She doesn't want to because you've come off the meds?
No, she doesn't want to treat me anymore because I want to taper the other one.
Well, why don't you just show her how well you're doing coming off the Cymbalta,
she's
and then
not,
maybe after a few weeks, maybe a month or so, you can show her that maybe you don't need the Lamictal. But to talk to her about it. Have you had seizures? Hello?
Never.
Okay. Well, listen, I'm going to say goodbye now. Thank you so much for calling. Bye-bye now. I want to move on now and talk about how we don't need these drugs. First, I want to tell you, well, I'll just go through a few things. When I worked in the state mental hospital as a volunteer, we talked the superintendent of the hospital into letting a whole bunch of us, about 14 of us, have our own patients. And they gave us these so-called backward patients that we as college volunteers couldn't hurt. And we got all but three out of the hospital in a year, and only a couple came back in the follow-up period. So I found out right away that what people who are really down and out and disturbed and even hallucinating and deluded, what they always need first and foremost is human connection. I then found out later that there'd been a whole era of moral psychiatry, really not even psychiatry, moral therapy, often hospitals run by Quakers in the late 1700s and the 1800s and some into the 1900s, early part of the century, in which all kinds of people came in and were treated without physicians. They were treated with exercise. They were treated with care. They were treated often with a Christian moral love. They often, as I said, these hospitals run by Quakers or other religious individuals. And looking back on all of this and reviewing it, the best review by Bachoven, you can find it again in my book, Brain Disabling Treatment, found that, in fact, people were getting well at least as quickly and without the adverse effects of modern treatment. Well, more recently, the World Health Organization did a survey of the effect of antipsychotic drugs in third world countries and underdeveloped countries versus in the European countries. And they thought they were going to find that people got more drugs and did better in the European countries. What they found out was that people got better in the undeveloped countries where they got fewer drugs and had an extended family. And the more research they did, the more they refined it down to the fact that what people were benefiting from was a combination of no medication or very little medication and a family support system that didn't reject them and put them into state mental hospitals. Then, based on this and on the work of R.D. Lang and other people who treated patients severely ill, severely disturbed, it's really not an illness, but severely disturbed, not a physical illness, Lauren Mosier developed something called Soteria House. You can find this in my books, too, or you can get it right on the web, in which she found that people in a residential home-like setting, like an old Victorian home with just a few patients and a few non-medical therapists, did better than patients in a mental hospital. And they actually had a control. They sent some first break patients having their first breakdown to the mental hospital, and some went to the Soteria House. So again, human contact, human caring, help people through acute psychotic breaks better than drugs in mental hospitals, and people didn't get all these horrible diseases I've been telling you about from the drugs. Now, in each case when these things, these alternatives work, psychiatry clamps down on them. And in Lauren Mosier's case, he was eventually fired from NIMH, where he was head of schizophrenia branch when he was doing this. And eventually California, after many, many years of success with Soteria House, stopped funding it. Now there's a group called Open Dialogue in Lapland, Finland, where they do the very best kind of work. In this one area, this one city, when a person has a psychotic break, they immediately bring a team into the home. They don't lock a person up. They bring a team into the home, and they don't give antipsychotic drugs to begin with. They just don't do it to begin with. They work with the family in family therapy. They'll work with individuals. They'll give a little help to the family during the crisis, maybe somebody to babysit, give the family a break. They will be very welcoming of the person's symptoms. They try to understand and see what the meaning of the symptoms are. And as a result of this, they have a fantastic record of success. 2/3 of the patients in Lapland get no exposure to the antipsychotic drugs at all, and 1/3 get only occasional exposure, and only 1/6 of patients stay on for any length of time. The result is people are getting cured so quickly before the 6 months are up that required for a diagnosis of schizophrenia. See, it's called schizophreniform if it doesn't last more than 6 months. There's hardly any more schizophrenics in Lapland. The disease is disappearing in Lapland. And overall, these people are mostly in school or employed, 73% on a 5-year follow-up of people with initial psychotic breaks. 73% of them were at work or in school, and only 7% were unemployed. These are incredible findings. So disability has been reduced because these psychiatric drugs cause massive disability. They're the major cause, psychiatric drugs, of disability in America today. So in Lapland, you've got this incredible demonstration. Now, unfortunately, the rest of the country, of Finland, this guy just don't want to have anything to do with this. So even though this has been going on for 20 years as a success in this one area of Lapland, which is an urban area, it's not out in the sticks somewhere, it's an urban area, even though that's going on, psychiatry still resists, resents, and suppresses the alternatives. In my own clinical practice, I never start people on psychiatric drugs. I might occasionally give a sleeping pill. And I think there's a place for occasionally giving something to just calm a person down gently. In the Lapland group, they occasionally give a tranquilizer in small doses, but they don't have the people stay on them. But in my own practice, I almost never even do that. I work with myself and with relationship. And if a person's having an initial breakdown, you can almost always, always help them markedly. But what we need is more Lapland experiences, and they call it open dialogue. You can Google open dialogue, and or Dr. Jay Sekula, S-E-I-K-K-U-L-A, S-E-I-K-K-U-L-A. Thank God for the internet. You can get all this information, but psychiatrists, my profession, the drug companies, avoid all of this like the plague, because it is a plague on psychiatry. All the success of the alternatives, whether you're looking at the World Health Organization studies or my volunteer program, which went on for decades before they shut it down, or you're looking at Soteria House, or you're looking at the Open Dialogue, or there was also milieu therapy that was very successful during the 60s and 70s, where wards without drugs really just wrap themselves around the patients in a caring way. And one of the things I'm trying to accomplish with our empathic therapy center, the official name is the Center for the Study of Empathic Therapy, Education, and Living. You can get to it at empathictherapy.org. We had a great conference a few weeks ago. You can come to our next conference and find out about it already by going on to empathictherapy.org. Sign up in advance. People are already signing up a year in advance. I think we're going to fill. We almost filled this year. We'll probably fill next year. And we're going to try to keep it in a really good, warm environment because we believe in those kinds of environments. Well, people all over the world are helping deeply disturbed human beings in their private practices and where they can within institutions. But it's very hard to do it in an institution because they will shut you down. They will fire you because everything I'm saying undermines the most fundamental principles of psychiatry. And in particular, what I'm saying today about the fact that psychiatric drugs are horrendously toxic, particularly the ones used to treat people who are considered psychotic, the so-called antipsychotic drugs. They're horrendously toxic. They do an enormous amount of harm. They do very little good. And there are better methods. Recently, I was challenged that if I wanted to come give a talk to psychiatrists, I'd have to be prepared to do a critique of all the good studies that show how well the antipsychotics work. And I said, I'm glad to do that. Just give me the studies and I'll come. You give me the good studies that you think that you can find. There's all these good studies you can find. I said to the psychiatrist, give them to me. It's not up to me to find them. I've already looked. I don't see any. So you find them and I'll critique them. I'll come and I'll critique them. Well, I never heard from them again because there aren't good studies showing that the neuroleptics are effective. At best, they cause a temporary lobotomy, which makes people more amenable to control. And there's another myth about this that's worth addressing. And that myth is that the antipsychotic drugs emptied the mental hospitals. Well, they didn't. They didn't. The antipsychotic drugs came in 1954. The mental hospitals didn't begin to empty until the 60s. In fact, they kept filling and filling and filling. They had more and more drugged people in the mental hospitals. The drugs didn't help anybody leave the hospital. They helped people be zombie-like in institutions. That's what the drugs do, whether it's a prison or a rambunctious child at home, or whether it's a psycho prison in Russia, whether it's a nursing home, whatever it is, or an acute treatment center, any place you are, or whether you're in veterinary medicine, the creature given the drug becomes more docile, easier to manage, and more zombie-like. That's it. That's what these drugs do. They're not curing anybody. They didn't help anybody leave the mental hospitals. For a decade, the hospitals just kept building up and building up because, wow, it was a miracle. You could just house thousands of people, 10,000 people often in this same place, same hospital, huge hospitals. Literally, they were like feudal systems with their own farms. You could tell the people, go rake here, go do this, go do that. As long as it was simple and menial, they would do what they were told. As long as they didn't do anything too complicated. And they were run like feudal systems. So the drugs didn't empty the hospitals, not one whit. What emptied the hospitals was they got so full with all these drugged, zombie-like people, there was no more room. And even though the states were spending like $2 and $3 a day and no more on their keep, because they were practically starving people to death and depriving them of all the normal amenities as well as their freedom, it was getting too expensive. So what happened in various places around the world is the state legislatures or the provincial legislatures started saying, we're not going to fund these facilities anymore. You got to empty them. And that's what happened. People didn't leave because they were helped. They were literally thrown out. And you can tell wherever that process went on, you can tell by when the legislatures took action. So it occurred at a very different date in Sweden than it occurred in the U.S. or Great Britain, the emptying of the hospitals. Strictly a political administrative decision. So where did the patients go? Well, we had this huge increase in street people at that time. Huge increase. A lot of people just ended up on the streets. They had a huge increase in people going into the nursing homes because so many of the people who were being drugged up were elderly. And then you had these new facilities being developed, these home-like facilities that were really more dismal than the state mental hospitals, where you'd have 10 patients living in a home drugged up, and then during the day they'd have to go sit in the park drugged up. They had less being offered to them in the state mental hospitals. It is a total myth that these drugs emptied the mental hospitals. They did turn people into zombies, which made them easier, makes people easier to keep wherever they are, and easier to just have them stay on the streets. These drugs don't cure anyone. It's a total fabrication. Now, when a person is horribly schizophrenic, that is, and I don't use that diagnosis, but it describes a person who's really demoralized and falling apart and sees things and hears things that are unreal. That person has lost touch with human reality, lost trust, total trust of other human beings. That human being is afraid and ashamed to be near other human beings. What does that human being need? What is needed under those circumstances? An invitation back into human relationship. That is what's needed. And you can literally, if you're an experienced therapist and you believe in yourself and you believe in the other human being, you can literally sit with somebody and bring them out of a psychosis in minutes by getting them to engage with you. And while they're engaging, you can say to them, are you hearing anything? And the odds are they will say no. By the way, you can see my training film now. It's brand new. I have a new training film, the Empathic Therapy Training Film. And in one of the training episodes, there are three training episodes. This is 4 hours long. It's got an introduction. It's got a critique by other therapists. It's got a three lengthy one-hour episodes of therapy. In one of them, the only one which is a wholly made-up, enacted episode, because I didn't want to have somebody that disturbed to join. I didn't feel that somebody could volunteer. But one of my colleagues played that role, and you get to see me engage somebody who's hallucinating, violent, and suicidal. And you actually see the process unfold as real as life itself. You can help people with a caring intervention. Some will need a safe place. That safe place should exclude the drugs and bring in empathic therapists. We're working toward that. We literally don't anymore have a place like that in the US or Europe because they've all been knocked back by organized psychiatry. But that's what we have to look forward to really building places, farms, places in the country, good places where human beings can help each other as was done for a century during moral therapy by relating in a moral, caring way to other human beings. I've been really glad to present to you this great overview of the antipsychotic drugs and better alternatives. I hope it will move some of you to seek better help and others of you to offer better help. Thank you very much.
You've been listening to the Dr. Peter Bragan Hour with a new live show every Monday evening at 5 p.m. East Coast time on the Progressive Radio Network, where each show is archived for your convenience. You can learn more about Dr. Bragan and his lifelong reform work on www.bragan.com. That's B-R-E-G-G-I-N.com.